Hello, Bob.
Hey, Ben. Good to be back. It's 2010.
You know, I found myself really looking forward to talking to you, and I think the reason was that when I talk to you, I'm naked. I don't mean literally naked, although I could be. It wouldn't really matter. But I don't need anything. I just talk to you. That we found a pure form, and purity is hard to find. It's very unusual. And usually all my other activities, I realise I'm very cluttered up with a little bit of recording I made there, or a track I want to play, or a quote, or something from a book, or some memory, or I'm always cluttered up with stuff. Like, I go out bristling with materials in order to deal with people. And what I think we're pursuing is something where we don't have any of that. We just talk to each other. And I'm wondering how many other people are doing this. Are you aware of this being a new mode that everybody's falling into, that everybody's dropping all their stuff and able just to speak to each other? Or is it something that we're pursuing that's special?
It's interesting, because I know talk show hosts just wing it. They have to do it every day, maybe a Rush Limbaugh or someone else, Howard Stern. They know that there's so much going on that they can talk about it, and they have their pat framework. They fit in everything into.
But they're very dependent, aren't they, on a famous guest? They're very dependent on somebody who they can ask banal questions of, and because of who they are or who they're considered to be in the public eye, everything's going to be interesting. Whereas neither of us are interesting at all in that way. I mean, I'm not going to find out anything about you that anybody's going to be interested in, because you're a mystery. Nobody knows who you are.
Right. I want to say that Rush Limbaugh is the only guy who basically doesn't have guests, and he has that energy of always thinking and having something to say. But what's different, so I'm pointing out that under electric conditions and so much content's provided, many producers of content in the software world are winging it.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
What's different, though, is that we're live, and I don't need to be on the radio to be have an audience to be alive and thinking and responding. And that's what I bring to you, and you have the same thing. But we can't paradoxically have an agenda, but it's a subset of just being great to be alive and knowing we have so much to enjoy. We're not bothered by issues, or I'm not bothered by issues that much.
No, insofar as we get into ideology, it seems to emerge from reflecting on the pleasure we get from talking to each other, that we've decided it's a revolution and that it has all these consequences, but that's because we're reflecting on what happens when we talk with each other. We haven't come along with some kind of, we didn't have protocols where we argued out our position on anything. We accepted the fact that we took pleasure in each other's company. I mean, we were sparked off by actually meeting in the flesh, weren't we? That you came to London and we had a few days together. And
well, I was struck after a few hours of talking that first day, and you were still in your bathrobe, and Esther was nursing Mordecai. Within like three or four hours, you go, "This is like Danny Houston."
Ah, yes.
I didn't expect that. You know what I mean? I didn't know that I would be go to the top of the food chain immediately. You know?
Yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah. Well, this is because, and then we come to the Zappology, which unites us. Our interest in Zappa, isn't it? Because Danny Houston was my guru for finding out about Frank Zappa.
But, and it was his energy, though. But see,
yeah,
what
yeah,
happened
and,
when we went over to visit Gamma many hours later, you got depressed because you thought I was a fanatic eventually. See, that's this manic up and down is still lurking there.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe I particularly enjoy the way that I can box you into 1 hour Skype a week and get it all in there. And there's no kind of flowing out beyond that. And you don't come out. Skype is useful because it keeps somebody within the time frame. You know, you have to book a particular time in which you talk to someone. So they're not going to pester you between whiles or pop up or demand to have a pork sandwich suddenly or want to go out to the pub with you or not go out to the pub with you. You know what I mean? You don't have those problems.
Yeah, that's a good point. So,
but are we approaching, therefore, the pure exchange of ideas, which is the seems to be the direction which the Platonic Symposium goes into, where we leave behind all the fleshly things and become pure spirits discursing way above all the earthly pleasures. In a way, it isn't, is it? Because we look forward to these as a kind of a fairly low pleasure, that talking with each other and the kind of zappological basis of it, or the way that we both developed our ideas through Frank Zappa, it's a kind of unallowed luxury to wallow in this and not feel we have to explain all the time, because it's a real uphill struggle to explain to, I don't know, an artist you meet in the art scene. You might find their art quite interesting, and finding that they have never encountered Zappa, you feel something's missing from what they are, that they haven't realised that all their ideas of art versus the commercial world, or their kind of set ideas of what are the oppositions, have all been completely twizzled around by Zappa, and they haven't even looked at that, and they're not interested in looking at that. And it kind of makes you feel everything's set, and that, you know, when you're a baby or when you're very small, did you have formal meals at home? And did you sometimes go under the table and meet another child and giggle? Did you ever do that?
I don't think so. I mean, who would I meet?
Well, maybe other children. I mean, I just remember we used to have very formal meals with my older brothers, and everyone would talk about politics. And the release of getting under the table and crawling under the table and having a joke with another child is kind of how I feel when I'm talking to you.
You know, that's an important point. I did not have those kind of dinners, but I once mentioned to Jerry Fialka that I love my memories of laughing with someone in, like, under the table environment, in the corner, and it's sort of childish. And then Jerry said, well, we always did that. Everybody did that.
Mm. Can you remember the feeling?
All guys and their friends and their teams did this. But I thought, no, I archetypal. I knew that was the most fun of all.
Mm. But it's before teens I remember it. And I remember an incredible feeling of superiority that we had. In fact, my older brothers, who were going through adolescent phases and getting very serious about this and getting very angry with my parents, we used to laugh at them. And we used to have a feeling of we were the Übermensch, even though we were the younger ones and the suppressed, and, you know, our ideas weren't taken seriously. We had a kind of a carelessness which made us feel so superior to these burdened adults. And that fun is something which Danny Houston always insisted on. And it confused me because I was the youngest child in my family. I didn't really feel very comfortable around children. I didn't understand children. He absolutely adored children and ended up working in a truants home. He did a course in childcare and got away from his boring job. And he always insisted that if children came, things were more fun. And now I can see it, you know, having been around children. I see that there's a whole superiority to the careworn adult networks of anxiety and so on that we get locked into, and that Frank Zappa is key to that, you know, to that attitude, or rather that attitude is key to understanding him.
We never knew we'd be talking about this, but this is an important point. That laughing with my buddies when I was a teenager and feeling superior, which I've often thought about, I definitely had that feeling. And in McLuhan's PhD thesis, he quotes somebody, Socrates or somebody, saying, no, maybe it was a Catholic thinker, that there are those who are born in a state of grace and those that aren't. And those that aren't born in a state of grace, when they look into the esoteric, into the mystical, into the out of the way, under the table, they take it and get distorted. And I think he said that, McLuhan said, that's what happened to Edgar Allan Poe and maybe Byron. I always felt that I had arrived in a state of grace. Or when I read that quote, I said, oh yeah, I arrived in a state of grace. Because when I met you, I was still laughing with my friends, never stopped. And the kind of exchange I have with everybody who's similar to that, and I've been doing it on the radio for 25 years. So I've always been, quote, stoned. I mean, many people claimed 30 years ago, Bob, are you on speed? You know, and I was not. I never did that kind of drug. But I was on the energy of the giggling under the table and feeling superior. But people didn't know I felt superior. That's the point. They didn't know. They thought I was a good guy and accepted them or made them feel part of it. You know what I'm saying?
I mean,
this superiority aspect is what Zappa and Beefheart, you knew that Zappa and Beefheart were carrying on from their high school giggling or laughing or snickering or raucous laughter, whatever level. They were like that in high school and never stopped.
Yeah, well, it's when you mention Beefheart, you nail it for me, because it's definitely for me a collective thing. This superiority was, I couldn't have it on my own. On my own, I'd feel rather deflated and miserable. It was with other people, other children, we built up this laughter. And I think the most attractive way of thinking about Frank is if you associate him in your mind with Captain Beefheart and their pleasure in each other as young people, and the kind of that if you take Zappa on his own, and particularly you get some hardcore Zappa fans who try and get a pure Zappa without themselves in it, and then you can get into this solitary genius sitting there cutting up his tapes, and it turns into something which I don't think it really is or should be, that it's the and it's particularly the confrontation with Beefheart, with someone so completely opposite. You name a thing, and you could almost say that Frank will be opposite to Don on it, about work or love or all these things. They took opposite lines on them, and it's listening to them, these two opposites, able to completely enjoy each other, which is the release. And so I think
that's the democratic part I'm saying. Acceptance. I may feel superior, not to the person I'm laughing with, but I have the superiority thing. We're laughing about the others. And the person doesn't, and the person feels he's sharing on an equal level. There was another point. I always, you know that Zappa kept that, we'll call high school attitude or high school age level of, the wonderful, the way a 16 or 18 year old feels great and loves life. It's all before him. And he's having a good time because he doesn't take it seriously in some way. For some reason, he has a state of grace and knows that it's not important, is that he shows that because he always had new young members in his band who loved being with him.
Yeah.
All the later,
fresh
the
blood.
Steve Vai, Chad Wackerman's, you see them now. They're hypnotized by Zappa, but when they talk about the rehearsals, the fun they had, which shows you, I mean, can you see that? Is Charles Mingus, did he bring on younger guys, 20, 30 years, 20 years younger? Did Duke Ellington do that? Maybe Duke did. He lived long enough. But isn't it sort of unique that Zappa was so old and had such young players?
I think it's right to mention those names and Sun Ra. I think it's band leading. I think you do need younger players. And I find when you talk about Zappa alumni and them describing Zappa, I think often a really sick thing happens. I find it very boring and repellent. And it's when they start telling you what a genius Frank was, and you know that they're kind of lying, because I think what Frank did to them actually is remove a certain inhibition and regard about other people's opinions. He made them be silly. He made them revert to being an infant. And I think they're quite embarrassed about that, a lot of them, particularly the ones who are now more famous. And they won't actually tell you what went on because it's too silly. It's too embarrassing.
That's right. And Zappa brought it out of them. They don't. They want to say he's a genius, but what they really mean is he was always younger than us.
Yeah, yeah.
He was always sillier and more immature.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. But in trying to find a term for that at one point, I coined the oxymoron, Zappa's delinquent principles. But it's a strange formulation, because the whole idea of being a delinquent is presumably you don't have any principles. That's what's wrong with you. That's why you're delinquent. But he seems to remember it's not all joy. There's also anger in it and a feeling of rejection by normal society. And he kept that in his, even as he developed and became famous, there was still that spike, that memory.
Yeah, and you know who doesn't get that is Barry Miles. his disgusting book about Frank. It may all be true, the grievances that he expresses about Frank, but he misses the teen Frank that always was there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's what Barry Miles misses. They couldn't believe that this super talented musician, composer, and thinker could be such a jerk, or not a jerk, an idiot, or so not serious.
Mm. But then
he didn't even care if he was remembered.
But then it's also Barry Miles' own stupidity and limits, is that he's got no framework for thinking about what it is to make music. I mean, he has no musical framework. What I mean is an imagination about what music is and where things might fit in it, so that he can't place Zappa's drives. He can't see his response to Edgar Varese. All that for him is completely closed book. He's thinking entirely in terms of morals and success, and these maybe being in conflict, and that's the only dynamic. And he has no idea of the objectivity of fantastic music. And I'm bringing that up, Bob, because in these discussions, sometimes you talk about we're transcending music, that our shows are for people who've learnt a lot through music, but are now like they were there. Their water wings, and they've now shed them and they can swim, and all we do is talk. And I'm unhappy with that. I feel that this musical principle, if you limit it to me, I'm talking to myself.
You're the person who said you want people to talk after the musical experience. That's what I was referring to. You're the one who lives to talk after the musical experience.
Absolutely, yeah.
But that you're also immature, like me, and you go into the opposite view. You see, you don't stay on one side. Now you're saying, no, Bob, let's enjoy the music. Let's not talk.
Well, let's not forget that we're talking about the music, and also that the music is our term for an experience that was unheralded in us, so it might not. We might not have thought it was music before it happened to us. We might have despised it. We might have thought that's not an area of an experience that we could call musical. That I think real musical experience is a continual growth system where things which previously you would have rejected as noise or an interruption or unpleasure suddenly get transformed into this very extraordinary and valuable and beautiful thing. And it's that transformation which is important, and that. Whereas once you corral a whole lot of things and say these are examples of music, a kind of deadness comes in that makes me always wonder what the scratching of the fingers on the side of the book that you're reading actually are. And it's the entry of that all the time in Zappa, which I find so refreshing. Today on the radio I played Canard du Jour. It's the last track on his Shut Up and Play Your Guitar box set. Which is like three CDs in a box. Right at the end, he's doing a duet with Jean-Luc Ponty, and it's very ethnic sounding, and Zappa's playing bouzouki, and it's very serious sounding, and Jean-Luc Ponty's playing a baritone violin in a very breathy way that almost sounds like a flute or a saxophone or something like that. And in the middle, suddenly you hear one of those funny little voices that Zappa puts in, the band members or a roadie, and he's saying, makes you feel like you're going home. And this reference to home, this sudden little bit of spoken word. And I was playing it on the radio, and I had headphones on, and I had problems with my mini disc and things happening, and my 21 months old is saying things. And I didn't know where this voice came from, but it was talking about going home, and he's playing ethnic music. And it seemed to me like a whole thing about where is our home. And he found a home and found his guitar sounded like a bouzouki. And for Zappa, home is not North America, but actually it's the Mediterranean and the folk musics of the Mediterranean. And suddenly this thing about home came in, and it was just like, this is fantastic, because it's commenting on the music, but it's in the music. It is actually part of the music, but it's stuff that people would say, well, that's not music, having a little snippet of verbal suddenly,
right?
But that for me is music, and that is philosophy, and that is radio. Is all the snippets should go in.
Yes, I heard that. I listened to the show before we started talking here, and I heard that note, that little thing. I mean, it's the guys who were around Shake Your Booty.
That's right. There's the same. I think Davy Moir, the recording engineer, was one of the voices. Anyway, whoever they were. But did you notice that voice coming in, and did it give you a surprise? I mean, do you know the track well? Were you waiting for it?
I haven't heard it in a long while, but I recognized it once it happened, but I didn't know it was coming, the voices. Mm. And then it happened. I thought, was that a mistake? Had Ben put... No, that's part of it. You know, it made me wake up.
Yes, exactly. That's why I like that so much. And all the things which people hate in Zappa, I remember my student friend saying, oh, no, don't put a record on the discrete label on it. It'll have somebody coughing on it. And it's precisely those moments which I think are musical, that what... If your idea of music is a kind of a known texture or pattern that soothes you, that's not actually music. That's actually nothing happening. And it's these moments where you're surprised and suddenly you don't know what you're listening to. You're disoriented. That somehow is where you actually open up to experience.
Yeah, now that's valuable. And then you bring in, it's not in the order that you played today, and then you bring in the Penguins. The shift to the raw sentiment or emotion of the Penguins is really a great experience in itself, as opposed to the waking up. You enjoy falling asleep again. And then you played the Elvis, and then you had Mingus. The whole mixture is perfect.
Mm, well, I always want to play Elvis to people who I get in the... You know, if you are interested in a guitar player like Derek Bailey or a... saxophonist like Lol Coxhill. In other words, you're interested in the best musicians who are around in London, or were around, rather, talking about Derek. You want to talk about them, so you find other people to talk about, and then you suddenly find yourself in this horrible world of alternative music where your superiority as a person is bound up with liking things that nobody else likes. And it's at that moment I just have to play some Jerry Lee Lewis or Elvis, or, you know, I have to play something which everybody loves and is really good, just to reassure myself that I'm not in that horrible little spiky corner.
Yeah, now part of the reason we eventually continued talking to each other is that we found out we had the same interests, literary or root bases, Wyndham Lewis, rare, unknown ones, Finnegan's Wake and Wyndham Lewis and that. And so there was this thread. It's interesting, the mixture of tradition and a certain thread of... artistic sensitivity or sensibility. At the same time, we also enjoyed that we didn't get stuck in any preference. See, when I got back from April 2008, started listening to your show, I knew if I listened to the new Ben show, I'm going to hear some stuff that I haven't heard in a while, and it'll be good, and it'll be mixed in with other stuff I hadn't even thought of. It's the mixture. So I listened to your show to reinforce that I'm not specialized in any taste.
But are we therefore postmodernists? Because one of the arguments that we hear again and again is that mixtures of high and low, that's what it's all about now. We're all postmodern now. We all accept everything. So it almost sounds like we're part of that. Are we part of that?
No, and that's where my four-bodied model is important. You cannot avoid the TV body and the chip body, which is an information overload environment that's saturating you in cars that drive by or commercials and all kinds of things is an acoustic experience. You can't stop that. And sometimes you like what you're hearing, sometimes you don't. And to have an opinion about that is irrelevant. That is the postmodern acceptance. They forget their chemical body, the physical body, and the issues of that. And that's what you use, Marx, as a marker and a guide for your chemical body issues. And so on our chemical body level, we have this thread of Marx, McLuhan, Joyce, Lewis, Zappa, you know, the Manipian tradition, the annoying tradition, because we see as political on behalf of the chemical body. But we have to recognize that you can't stay stuck in your chemical body. You have this other bodies, and that's why the public discourse is so confused.
Yeah, well, what you call the chemical body, I have a reaction against its use in art, the insistence on, I suppose you could call it classical humanism, but the idea that a real art should portray naked figures, it should portray, you should go and see stage shows where real emotions are shown. And I have a kind of absolute rebellion against that, and I'd rather go to plays which are about the seating in the theatre, and I'd rather see paintings that are about the edge of the canvas. And I have a kind of a complete horror of the sentimental staging of what you call the chemical body, or what I call the existential body, the physical body, as some kind of key to art. Do you know what I mean? You go into an exhibition, it's all charcoal drawings of ankles.
No, that's the point.
Or breasts.
There is the chemical body. But our tradition does not identify with the chemical body. But what confuses that is the discarnate electrified environment, chip body and TV body, that does the same thing as our attitude in relation to the chemical body. It actually reinforces the ignoring of the chemical body. And so that's why the postmodern ethos and the art school thing about just being a rebel and that's all is so irrelevant. And it gets confused at that point, how to explain or tease that apart. Because what you object to the postmodernism, and I object to the postmodernism as a reflex ideology that just goes along to get along because that's the fact. What was good about McLuhan, he says, look, we're not forever postmodern. We turn off the TV environment. We will not be postmodern anymore. So it's not something you form a dogma or ideology about. You are forced to live that way while the environment is happening, the electric environment. But you don't forget the chemical body issues. But our tradition is we don't identify with the chemical body. So that's why we don't go for the nature freaks or the classical humanist revivals of the great traditions of the Gutenberg era. You can say the chemical body is the literate body, you know, the thing that was raised on literacy. But we're not limited to that. See? So if you look at the electric environment as sabotaging the Gutenberg body, we were always part of that, our tradition, even when there was only a Gutenberg body or chemical body. You see? So when you see all these people adopting the alternative mask in the schools and are taught to be that way, you see there's something fraudulent about that. What's fraudulent is they're going along with what they're being taught.
And they're not paying attention to the medium that they're using. They're pretending their medium's transparent and a window on the real body, whereas somebody could be using what might look like completely cybernetic, abstract, electronic things, but manipulate them in a way which is expressing their chemical body to the utmost. It might become the most sensitive register of their body. What I mean is that you might find that a performance of Beethoven by a real string quartet in a room is actually a completely jaded and frozen reproduction of something that once had some power, actually preserving the kind of values that you see on television, whereas a record, which might seem just like a piece of plastic produced in a commercial way, might have an electric guitar on it that registers the automatic reflex of fingers in response to what the modern environment is doing to us, which has an expressive power and which you immediately sympathize with because you imagine your own fingers on strings and the situation you'd have to be in to produce such strangled noises. And therefore the things, it's like something's paintings which are on both sides of a canvas or a piece of paper that you can turn it over and the complete opposite to what you expect might be imprinted there.
Yeah, I have two ways to go with this. I just happened to see a clip of Robert Anton Wilson saying just before he passed on that in the end everything is all words and words are metaphors. And that's what he was wrestling with. That is an inadequate statement. It is not all words. Now, what's interesting is that McLuhan said all media, all inventions have a linguistic character. A grammarian could reduce them to the phrase, the parsing of grammar and that media are words. But to be logocentric or to identify with the words and say that's the ultimate medium misses the golden opportunities that are happening right now for nonverbal, postverbal, preverbal expression.
Well, it's the most, but it sounds like the most boring thing you could say with words is to insist on the importance of words.
Exactly.
For me, the most interesting thing to do with words is to flummox them and let them be impressed with other procedures which, by the indentation on the words, you become aware that there are real forces which are not words. They may be registered by the words. The words may be like a kind of putty, but what's pressing into them is something else. And if you're a skillful writer, it seems to me you make people aware of what all these real things are that are pushing your words around. So far from saying that words are supreme, you actually see words as a trace of real forces which are acting on us.
Yeah, the sampling that you were mentioning to me before is the common aesthetic now. People try to have, well, the postmodern mix high and low and mix everything, so a DJ might play different things. It is interesting to say that that sampling or that eclecticism will not be viable unless it includes the Zappa universe and all that Zappa came out of and what Zappa developed.
And the person who's absolutely not got Zappa in them and yet has done so many moves that look similar is John Zorn. It's very convenient. They both begin with Z. I remember a tape which John Zorn made for the poet Tom Raworth in which he included, isn't this clever, Japanese cover versions of the Beatles. And me and Tom were listening to them, and I said to him, but the problem is, it's really, you know, exciting and far out that he's researched this arcane material. This was before a lot of Japanese music had been exposed, and it seemed very, you know, kind of ridiculous, but kind of impossible to source, you know, amazing. But listening to it, it's actually not very good. It's not very likable. It's pretty crass stuff. It's not... It doesn't actually move you. And... it seems to me that John Zorn is an avant-gardist without the Zappological rudder, that he doesn't know where he's sailing, and that it becomes a business of proving that you've combined, aren't you shocking, because you combine this high and this low, but without any consideration of what those two things actually are. It becomes a sort of demonstration that you can do it, and it sort of hangs with the same sort of isolation from the world that artworks have in dull... or brilliant modern art galleries, where artworks don't have any push behind them, which gives them any social power. They're isolated as art. They just hover there, and some people really love that. They think that that's really cool and everything, and it is really cool for a certain layer of people. But for a real artist, it actually lacks vim. It lacks any kind of force. It's kind of isolated and not connected. Whereas what I like about Zappa's interest in both high art and low art, or as he said to me, any art at all, meaning things which haven't been turned into art at all, in other words, rubbish, is his own reaction to them are completely combined. So his absolute passion for Edgar Varèse, he totally loved Edgar Varèse. He needed him like he needed the Spaniels. And that's what I miss in the postmodern mixes, is that there's no lust for the materials themselves. They're merely combined as an exercise. There's something cool and detached about it that ultimately is really, really boring.
Yeah, that's what I mean by the Android meme. And on my chart, I have Zappa McLuhan. And the Android meme repeats, simulates, clones Zappa McLuhan. And that's what Zorn is. They're a simulation. Zappa is the only musician for our time. And if I only had Zappa to listen to, that would be enough. If I want to have a real music experience, I listen to Zappa.
Mm.
And so,
but Zappa's almost constructed like an encyclopedia, isn't it? Sorry. Zappa's almost constructed like an encyclopedia. That it's trying to swallow all musics.
Yeah, but let me continue the thought here.
Sorry.
I wanted to say that what Zappa did, and it's like Eric McLuhan states in his PhD on Finnegan's Wake as Menippean satire changes. It's never the same because the conditions change. And so Zappa was the great Menippean of his time. But if you're going to be a Menippean after Zappa, you would not be in music. I don't know where you would be. I would claim I'm it. And you would come to the position we say that you only talk about music. You don't engage it. You don't consume it. And what music would you talk about? I'm saying that Zappa wrapped up the musical experience. He's there forever. And if you don't get into Zappa, then you're just getting Android meme music. And you don't get into all the context and figure ground stuff that you find valuable in real music.
Well, that
this is
yeah.
This is an interesting point, is that if everything collapsed and there was no music, if I could play my Zappa, that would be enough, because he always amazes me at how good he is, and he's got the right timbre. And I don't think it's just a matter of taste. I like the timbre and pitch or something, the way he does a guitar. It's the whole work he did. So the problem with Zorn is he carried on the Zappa eclecticism, but he was a simulation of it, and he didn't know that music wouldn't make it that way anymore.
I mean,
what you mean by postmodernism is everything is a replay of something that is left out in the postmodern discourse.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about actual art is that nobody knows what it is. I remember Bob Cobbing, the London sound poet who's now dead, pointing at something on his table to me and says, the thing is that the literary establishment does not know what that is. And he pointed at this blob on a piece of paper that I just found incredibly exciting. He said, they don't know whether that's an architectural design, a ballet score, a poem, or a picture. And they were things he'd made on his photocopier. They were he photocopied pieces of rubbish and then used so much black that they became stronger in his photocopy than the so-called original. He'd throw the originals away because they were just litter. And he'd work on these things and produce these shapes on a piece of paper that were like something you'd never seen before. Now, that to me is what a real artist does. They don't go and repeat or fill the gap left by a previous artist and supply art. They go and act on the world doing something that only afterwards can people come along and really decide what the hell it is.
And yeah, and they always have the laughing teen sensibility.
But I think artists who work like that are also in need of having themselves explained back to them. And one of the things that we do with each other is explain to each other what we're doing. And I think you just explained to me what I do in poetry, because I am interested in modern writing in English. I'm interested in writing that isn't simply communicative on the conceptual level. I'm interested in words which have some kind of hypnotic weight or something on the page that makes me fascinated by them. And I think what I'm trying to do is demonstrate that needs Zappa. That without Zappa, that literature actually becomes hypnotized by various models of what poetry is, which lead in fascist and elitist directions. And
I know with my teen sensibility how absurd it is that I'm saying and stressing we only need Zappa. He wrapped it up, and that's all there is. That's a silly thing to say on so many levels, but on an important level, it's not. It's the correct thing to say, and to that degree that one could be correct, we're saying our show is the most correct statement on how you appreciate the present.
Yeah, because how else are you going to be able to compare the thing that you will hear immediately when you turn us off and look out the window or open a magazine or walk down the street or whatever else you're going to do? You're going to be confronted with something which a pre-Zappa art wouldn't be able to handle. Whereas we think we've learned from Zappa that every human manifestation is part of a comedy that we should appreciate, that the separations between people and the bitter differences and incomprehensions going on, at least people bumping into each other, are actually funny. I don't seem to be saying that in a very funny way.
Well, you made me laugh by saying that. You covered yourself. This demand that it's actually not consuming all of Zappa's albums, it's understanding his attitude, his cynical and loving hedonistic enjoyment of playing with people and getting away with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was interesting in the 80s and 90s, he would often say, you know, I don't see how if I showed up with the Mothers in the 80s, I wouldn't have got a record deal. You know, it was sort of interesting how he never thought he could have made it other than that time in the mid-60s, that he could have pulled it off. So what is it that he felt that it was totally controlled by the 80s and 90s? And so and there's all kinds of more...
Well, that's
wacky, I got the point.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of more wacky stuff than the Mothers that becomes the alternative industry in the 80s and 90s. But see, what Zappa meant was you can't get someone totally being outrageous like he was in the musical medium at the time he did it. And so you'd have to be outrageous in the Menippean tradition in a different way today.
Of course. It's very important that he arose at the particular dates he did, because the whole of music was undergoing a materialization, music was becoming more closely mapped to bodily needs than it had ever been before. There was an absolute revelation. It was like a cliff face had fallen down from all the formal things that people had been doing, thinking it was music, and sound was revealed. And this is to do with the way that the mass of people could get hold of music directly and actually hear recordings of what the musicians meant, instead of all the mediations of scores that previously they'd had to go through in order to get to the sound that a sound producer wanted to make. And that became that was absolutely explosive. And he writes himself about it, doesn't he? And the Oracle has it all psyched out, where he talks about this power of just playing these quite simple chords in quick succession on an electric guitar amplified is going to sweep the world. He knew it was going to. So he came in at a moment of absolute necessity for musical change, and it was connected with a whole politics and a whole social revolt. If you came in afterwards, the only people sponsoring music after that are people with political and financial interests, and therefore you can have some fairly worthy people like, say, Rage Against the Machine using the machinery that's been set up, but it has no aesthetic integrity because it's being used for different ends than the music itself. It's kind of being pushed around and tweaked, and then the very commercial people who want to sell something, or the very political people want to give a message to people, but it doesn't have the integrity of a necessary expression, which is where Zappa came from. So he had the strength that the window that opened up when he came in meant that his music had this basis in a kind of riot of and a hilarity and an eroticism of having sound directly express, and that people could share a total world view because of.
Okay, I had an idea here. You have the chemical body's ear collapses in the 60s. Zappa, an expert in the chemical body ear, immediately adopts and embraces the virtual ear, the electronic ear, and immediately exploits it to the max beyond any other of the traditional jazz, classical music. Their attempt to adjust was slower. Zappa outraged everybody by totally embracing the virtual situation. Like, doesn't he say on World for the Money in the notes, it's, this is not electronically altered, or this is electronically altered, but not electronic, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's a very interesting statement. You know what he says in World for the Money? Yeah. He makes this distinction.
It's real instruments being electronically manipulated. They're not electronic sounds being generated.
Right. He was pointing to the virtual thing. So he embraced it. And I think in your second edition of Negative Dialectics, don't you have the epilogue or mention the virtual part of Zappa's work or something? You bring that in. I remember it. Your later essay on that, and point that out.
It's always, I mean, the whole issue of electronic production of sound versus the manipulation of it. I mean, in that statement, we're owning it for the money, Zappa sounds like he's probably for budgetary reasons, but it sounds like a criticism of Karlheinz Stockhausen and the people who were getting control of synthesizers and making pure electronic music, where Zappa's interest was the mediation of electricity, of reality.
He was taking on the Supremes. That's the point.
And later on, he did use a Moog synthesizer. But, I mean, in a classic Zappa way, he goes and uses it in a context which Stockhausen couldn't go into, which is on Zoot Allures. He uses it on Disco Boy. He uses a Moog synthesizer creating electronic noises, and he produces a few fart sounds, which he adds to this stupid attack on disco music that sounds more like glam rock, actually. It sounds more like Mud or one of those sort of English glam rock bands from the early 70s, and it's like he hates all this music so much he can't even be bothered to satirize it correctly, you know, and it's just a kind of a complete rubbishing of pop music. And of course it's there that he decides to use the pure electronic sound of the Moog synthesizer.
Yes, now it's important to see that he that movie Amadeus about Mozart's ballet.
Ah, the one that inspired Dweezil to add a kind of classical bit to one of his records.
Yeah, mistake. Because what they should have taken Amadeus Mozart, whoever made that movie. They then should have showed Zappa the modern Mozart leaping in the mosh pit at the Mud Club or something. That's what Mozart, they were trying to show in the Mozart character, as opposed to the establishment guy, Santorini or whatever his name was. The point is that you had these kids in the 60s and 70s going to these special schools to be a composer, and they didn't recognize that the greatest composer was right there in your radio, if you could get on, making fun of Alice Cooper or the Supremes or everything. He was dealing with the present, exactly what McLuhan was pointing out. And it always was that he didn't care that it was collapsing. He didn't care that he was doing this. He also was supremely teenage-wise detached and superior to all the great stuff he was doing, because he knew the important thing was to stay alive and in tune. And responding to what's happening in the present to have joy.
That's so beautiful. I want to end the program right there, but we've got another 10 minutes, Bob. How are you going to cap that?
Well, I'm going to try cap to say what I meant. See, the emotion, I guess, communicates something to you there. But we have to realize...
No, I was understanding you conceptually, Bob. Credit me with that. I was following your logical concepts. And you are an iconoclast. You do not believe in the object. You're anti-commodity fetishism. You are arguing for what in religious terms would be called a spirit. You're arguing for the motion of the understanding as being the most important thing. And you add that to a democratic communist politics, which is arguing that it's people laughing and thinking and acting which is the key. And all this stuff we do is merely interventions in the vast sea of human activity which surrounds us, and that the modern world has given us incredible power to communicate with everybody, and therefore the responsible artist is putting their awe into this shimmering iridescent mud of everybody's communications, that's where the artist intervenes.
So
not imitating these
young kids. Yeah. Going to professional schools to get a gig as an opera director or whatever musical symphony, a traditional musical position their talent can fit into. They don't understand that the greatest composer all through the 60s, 70s, 80s was willing to drop it at any time and start a TV show or to do editing in Hollywood. He wasn't limited to being a musician. That's the important point I'm trying to make.
Mm. But I think it's different from, because there's a bad sense in that, in which, I mean, we are burdened with this notion of celebrity in Britain. I don't know how it hits in the States, but it's funny, the vocabulary for it has come from academia, where cultural studies tried to understand how the star system worked and produce the idea of the celebrity, but it's now become what these people say themselves. So the celebrity is everything. So once you're famous enough, everybody shifts over. You know, you make your name as a footballer, the next thing you're a novelist. I mean, it's something Guy Debord denounced in the 60s already, but it's become the absolute, you know, in a way, is this a criticism of us? Are we merely echoing the celebrity culture by dropping everything and talking naked? Because that's exactly where all the famous non-entities want to be. They want to lose any particular reason why we should they were originally famous, leave it behind and enter into everything else. So after they've made a certain amount of money, they go into real estate, they become bankers, exactly. So what's the difference? Why is Zappa different?
This dialogue engages you and me, and me, I'm a mystery person. Nobody would believe where I came from. That's what you've got going for you. This is nobody knows who or what I am, and so what am I being naked about? I'm just talking technically, as McLuhan said. I say this is the technical discourse that the chemical body must have in response to the multiple-bodied situation we're in.
Yeah.
For the revolution, which could be a revelation.
Yeah,
revelation. I'm not bearing anything about myself.
Yeah, but we often get most specific about what we're saying when we think Zappa through it, or think it through Zappa. So the difference between Zappa and an average celebrity being a novelist and a gardener and a chef on TV
and
everything.
Zappa would
because
find the place. If he was not allowed to record, he'd find the place to continue being his teenage fun-loving self.
Yeah, and it's It's even plastic in the sense that it's shaping everything into one, that all the sides are meant to reflect each other, that he's still building his project object, which in a sense is simply building your life in a satisfactory way, so that you feel he's not simply pursuing these different roles with the idea of being one of them. He's cross-relating exactly. them so That's that right. they reflect each other and shed light on each other. So when he has a proposal for a TV program, it's actually reflecting his attitude about how music is put together. When in Hot Rats he says it's a movie for your ears, he was talking about his own attempts to make films and his own idea of how films could be made. That he realizes that anything can be a metaphor for anything else, and that if you have the correct dialectic, or you have the, not a word he'd use, if you have the correct approach, you can use as a model for anything the particular thing you've done, so that a little pencil sketch that you do on the back of an envelope can become a scientific formula, or it can become a recipe for a meal, or it can be a composition. That all of these things are compositions, and if they actually are imprinted with the necessary physical spasm which relates to the way the world actually works, which hence the insistence on sexual deviation throughout his work, that if it can relate to this spasm, it has a relevance to any particular field we can work in, because we are all humans. So in fact, it's a radical humanism.
Yes, and he, and the testament to all these projects that he could do if given the opportunity were not allowed. He was always too yeah. far in whatever, like, you know, you could say David Bowie goes yeah. Goes over into Hollywood and does these different postmodern specialist activities. But he was allowed to do yeah. it. Anything Zappa proposed when he moved to another field, they would stop.
Well, he turned music into the possibility of music into a criticism of how everything else was going, because he had this window in the 60s when, I think, you see, music was privileged. I think in the 1920s and 30s, art was privileged, visual art was privileged, it was the thing. I think in the 60s, music was the thing. At the moment, I don't know what is the thing, but I think we're on to it.
Utility bin is what it is, and that's ESP and the simulation of that. It's what I do, Ben. I am the greatest living exponent okay. of this thing we're talking about.
I'll give you that, but there was something I was saying before you derailed me by your megalomania. We've only got 3 minutes to go and I've lost it. Can you bring me back to what I was saying?
You see, the reason we have good conversations is you have the same attitude as me. You think you are the greatest perceiver of what's going on right now.
Well, this has to be the stance everybody takes, because that's all you ever are going to perceive is what you perceive.
But
there's
you
no
can
use
back it up.
Trusting other people or believing, you know, rumors that somebody else is a seer. You've got to see it for yourself. I suppose my point would be that you also ought to point out to the greatest of your powers any errors you see around you, and make a nuisance of yourself everywhere in order to jam these other people's visions, which are getting in the way of how you could see it. And so but there's a point which I want to make before we finish, but I'm losing it, I'm afraid.
The point is Zappa grabbed the opportunity, and today it's a totally different situation. So to grab the opportunity would show up in a different form. That's the Menippean tradition. It
yeah,
always
yeah.
surprises people.
Well, it's the translation between forms of knowing that it's your stance vis-a-vis the social totality which is the creative part of it, and that it can be expressed in different ways, but not to get addicted to particular modes of that expression.
And that's why I say you can read a whole history of postmodernism with the grievance that you have towards it by Lyndon LaRouche, very articulate,
but in the end,
within the yeah. classical human tradition, and I can engage that. Not many other people can. I don't become a LaRouche, but I can bring it in. And no postmodernist will include LaRouche in their range of ammunition.
I haven't read LaRouche, but I'd say that this is the way in which I understand all art as politics, and which confuses the people who are into politics and art as separate fields, because I'm saying the only way to judge art is its stance vis-a-vis the social totality. And it's from there that you get everything. And if it's done properly, you can no longer see whether it's art or politics or indeed having a good life.
Well, that sums up what you were, what I pointed out, you know, many 20 shows ago, that this wrestling in you between aesthetics and politics, that's what, how you resolved it by what you just said.
But there is no resolution, because the attacks on us and the desire to close us down seem to be carrying on.
Yeah, are we going to be presented in the Zappa journal that's started?
Well,
Hatton journal. Apparently you're in it. You do your Ono, Yoko Ono thing, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, this kind of gossip should be reserved for after the show, and we've got to the end of it. So thanks very much for talking, Bob.
Well, I thought we were taking on the ones who were trying to shut us down.
We shall.
Okay.
Bye.